Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Manual Therapy Blog. I'm your host, Matt Thomason. Today we get a little shorter interview as we continue on with our series, and in it we're talking with Bill Boissonnault. Bill Boissonnault's a physical therapist who is currently the Executive Vice President of Professional Affairs with the American Physical Therapy Association. But if you don't know him for that, you probably have heard of his name in your entry-level PT program, because he has authored or co-authored a couple of pretty well-known books, one being Primary Care for the Physical Therapist, Examination and Triage, and the other, Pathology, Implications for the Physical Therapist. And the latter is probably the thickest book you might have purchased in PT school. So we have a shorter interview today with Bill just because he is a very busy person with the American Physical Therapy Association. And in our short interview with him, we learn of a couple of important milestones with the APTA that happened this past summer. And we got to learn more about him and his background from previous mentors that helped to shape his clinical practice in the past, and really how he got known for medical screening or got into that aspect of physical therapy. So I hope you enjoy it. It's, like I said, probably about half the length of our regular interviews on here at this point. But nonetheless, very informative and a pleasure to speak with Bill. If you enjoy it, please like us either on the webpage or Twitter, Facebook. And also don't forget about rating and liking us or writing a review on iTunes. We'd love to get some different things up on there if you listeners appreciate anything. So without further ado, here's my interview with Bill. Well, guys and gals, today we get to talk with another special person. His name is Bill Boissonnault. He is the Executive Vice President of the APTA, Professional Affairs, and among many other things in the past. So, Bill, thank you very much for joining us.
Matt, glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. Bill, since you're so heavily involved with the APTA and as well as, you know, other organizations in the past, like the American Academy and the orthopedic section, can you give us any updates on some current things that you're working on right now? Because I know the APTA hit a really important milestone this past week, I think, with numbers of membership. Anything else going on recently?
Well, we hit the 100,000 member mark, which is, we've never been at that level before. And we're very excited about that and look forward to building on that. I mean, we're all about membership. That's what drives us. And being the single national association for the profession as a whole, it is a big milestone. In my area, professional affairs, which encompasses education, practice, and research, there's a lot of things going on within education. There's been a big push to look at the professional education process and post-professional development tree or ladder. So the APTA Board of Directors have been making some big decisions related to entry-level education, collaborating with ACAP and the education section, other stakeholders. Clinical Education Task Force just presented a report to the House of Delegates this past June. So education certainly is at the forefront. Tying education and practice, one of the big things or challenges we face as a profession is unwarranted variation in practice. You know, the drive for evidence-based practice that's there for all the different disciplines. Well, variation in practice starts with variation in education. Mm-hmm. So we're really working hard to try to link those two, practice and education, and be evidence-based from start to finish. So that certainly has been a big area.
Yeah, certainly. Well, Bill, thanks for the update for that. Usually we have similar questions for each participant or each person being interviewed, just that we can get to know them better. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, where you grew up?
Sure. So I'm a Wisconsin boy at heart. That's where I grew up. I went to PT school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And prior to moving here to Alexandria 2 years ago, I'd been in Madison, Wisconsin for 23 years, working at the University of Wisconsin Hospital Clinics and at the PT program in Madison. You know, when I finished PT school in 77, I moved around for 15, 16 years, but if people asked me where home was, it was Wisconsin. I happened to live in different places, and so I currently live in Alexandria, but like I said, I'm a Packer fan. I'm an owner of the Green Bay Packers.
Awesome.
So that's home.
Cool. Yeah, home is where the heart is, right?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
So you graduated in 1977. What kind of influenced you to get into physical therapy back then?
Well, this is not going to be very inspirational. I really got in by accident. Back in those days, you didn't need to have any exposure to the field as part of the application process. And I had already been in an undergrad various programs for 3 years, and I was changing my major every semester. And at the end of a semester, I'd go back to the building that had all the hard copy brochures of different colleges at the university and was looking through them, and I saw physical therapy and occupational therapy. I'd never been to a physical therapist, and nobody in my family had been to a physical therapist growing up. And so I read the brochure. It sounded interesting. And you had to have X number of hours exposure to healthcare. So I was a nurse's aide for two semesters at the University of Wisconsin Hospital, and that met my requirement. Wow. So I got in. Somehow I got in and really knew nothing about the profession. Wow. Thankfully, it's turned out great. I love being a physical therapist, but you know, I'm fortunate that it turned out that way.
Yeah, I'd say so far you're doing pretty well.
But it's a very different process today, which is a really good thing. Yeah. I'm not sure I would have gotten in today, but I'm glad I got in when I did.
Well, Bill, one thing I can say for myself is, I remember being in PT school, and the first way I heard about, you know, your name in terms of physical therapy were the two textbooks that you either authored or co-authored, that being Primary Care for the Physical Therapist or the Pathology Implications for a Physical Therapist. I mean, that book was, you know, that thick. It was huge. It's like, I remember it being one of the heaviest books we had to lug around in PT school. But
I'm sorry. I apologize.
No.
Carrying it around.
No, I mean, both of them were fantastic. I mean, still look to them. In fact, one of my colleagues says every student that he has, he makes sure that they're, if they don't have the primary care book, that they're, you know, reading through it during their affiliation. So,
thank you.
Well, yeah, they're both of them, I think, are very important. So hopefully listeners at least have seen those if they don't own them. But, you know, you've also done many other things. You have a lot of awards given to you over the years. And you're a Catherine Worthingham Fellow of the APTA, right?
Yes. Yep.
So quite a bit of accomplishments.
Yeah, well, thank you. I've had some really good mentors along the way. I think the person who had the earliest mentor I had that changed my direction and trajectory as a clinician was Stanley Paris. I went through his master's program when it was in Atlanta, Georgia. So this was pre-St. Augustine days.
Oh, wow.
And a couple things. I came into that program really practicing at the level of a technician. And I left with the tools to evolve into a clinician. Hmm. And so in terms of mentoring related to clinical reasoning and problem solving, I mean, to me, that's when practice became fun. And Stanley's program really meant everything to me at that time. The other thing that he really influenced me in was the importance of advocacy for the profession at the association level. I mean, I'd been a member of APTA since my first year in PT school, which was then 4 years before that, 5 years before that. But I attended conferences with Stanley, as with the other students, and watching him in action, I was always very impressed. I was always very glad that he was one of us and not on the opposing side of some of the arguments. But I left there with the appreciation that I had a responsibility to give back to the profession, not just through the association, but very heavily through APTA. And so that was huge for me. And then in terms of the textbooks you mentioned, the pathology textbook and primary care textbook, there was a physician up in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Dr. Mike Koopmeiners. I had, through a patient's experience, realized that the scope of my exam was too narrow from a PT perspective, and I had a patient ended up being diagnosed with cancer, and I was upset about some of the things that I probably missed, and started looking for information related to this medical screening process. And there were no textbooks at the time for physical therapists. And you know, I found nursing textbooks and some physician textbooks, but Mike Koopmeiners was somebody that I had known through collaborative patient care. He had done some teaching with physical therapists, and it was with him that I developed my first course. I started teaching courses on this, but really as a clinician, he was there to mentor me along the way, because I had thoughts of, I have to go back to medical school to be a good PT. I didn't want to go to medical school. I was happy being a PT, and he finally convinced me I did not need to go to medical school, but I had to change my approach. And he was huge in that department.
Okay, wow. And so it was just your own desire that you weren't as comprehensive as you felt you needed to be that kind of drove that?
Yes. Yeah, it was my screening was not extensive enough. And just, you know, one of the things that evolved over time was when I would see a patient for initial visit, instead of assuming that physical therapy was where they belonged, when they started giving me their story, their history, my thought evolved to, all right, what's the worst thing this could be medically? And then try to convince myself it wasn't that. And so it was as much an attitude shift that ended up making a huge difference in my approach. Now, a majority of the patients that I think we see, including the patients I've seen, PT is where they belong.
But
I'd like to think I've missed a lot fewer things over, you know, the last, you know, 30 years of my practice compared to the first 10 years of my practice.
Yeah, and that's, I was just about to ask you, you know, after you were done with your what you were saying there, I was going to ask you, what do you normally help encourage younger clinicians to get better at that? So, I mean, you just kind of answered it, so that means nice to hear.
Yeah, it starts with an approach, and again, also understanding that this is a screening process, not a diagnostic process.
Yeah.
So it's all about probabilities. There's a lot of gray in this, but physical therapists, you know, graduates come out much better skilled and much better prepared than, you know, I did back 40 years ago.
So as an example, because I've gotten this from students that I've mentored over the years, say you do identify something that means that they're not appropriate to be in a physical therapy clinic for what, you know, whatever pathology or whatever diagnosis that may be, or what it turns out to be in the end. How do you go about that? And what do you say to the patient? What do you tell the physician or the referring provider when you talk to them?
Well, it's those are the two audiences. Patients, and I recognized pretty early in my career that you can't make a patient or a family member do anything they don't want to do. So my goal is to convince them that it's in their best interest to follow through with my recommendations. So depending on if I have fairly urgent concerns about their health status, then I'm more direct about what I'm concerned about, what I'm worried about. Could it be your heart? Could be related to your previous history of breast cancer, always with the caveat, I don't know for sure. And that's why I think we need to bring your physician into the mix. in terms of communicating with somebody in the physician's office, whether it's the nurse practitioner or the physician themselves, again, it depends on how urgent my concerns are and combined with how well do I know that other practitioner. If it's somebody I've worked with for 20 years, they know that I'm not under any pretext I'm trying to do their job, then there's no beating around the bush. I'm very direct.
Yeah.
If it's somebody I don't know well at all or don't have a great relationship with, then I may start out with, I'm convinced it's not X because of 1, 2, 3, and 4. It could be related something to their previous history of cancer or potentially heart problems or lung problems. And, you know, part of this communication part was a big part of my manual therapy training, which mm-hmm. happened the master's program with Stanley Paris, was communication was an emphasis and patient education was also an emphasis. And those are skills that I've carried with me since then.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's always nice to hear. I can think of an example recently where I strongly suspected a patient had signs and symptoms of cauda equina. And bless him, I mean, he was the kind of guy whose back was feeling better. You know, some of his other symptoms were feeling better, so he felt like, well, if it ain't broke, I don't need to. I tried to, in the end, just tried to scare him a little bit and say, look, this is what could be an issue. You know, I really need you to, you know, do what your doctor says, because at that point I had spoken with his referring provider. And like you said, you can tell them everything in the world, but they're going to do what they're going to do in the end.
Yes, that's right. Sometimes you do need to scare them a little bit.
Yeah.
To try to get them to follow through. But, you know, again, that's where my manual therapy background, and that's where those skills really began when I started my training in manual therapy.
Okay. So you mentioned Stanley Paris as a big figure and mentor in your past. Do you have any other mentors along the way?
Well, it's not necessarily a mentor, but there was very little manual therapy. When I was in PT school in 1976 and 77, manual therapy was, it really wasn't being taught. It wasn't part of PT education.
Right.
One of my PT school instructors went to one of Stanley's first courses, a two-week course, and came back and tried to teach us the material in 2 days.
Oh my
and we
gosh.
Had never even had the convex concave rules or anything in biomechanics. And so, you know, it went way over my head. So I've been practicing about 3 years. So I was in Colorado Springs. And I've been there for a while. I ran into a patient that I had discharged. I ran into her at a shopping center. Mm-hmm. She had neck pain and headaches, and I didn't help her at all. And so we started talking a bit. I said, you know, can I ask, how's your neck and headaches? And she said, I'm much better. And I knew it hadn't been anything that I had done. So I asked her, I said, so what happened? You know, how'd you get better? And she described going to another physical therapist in town. His name was Neil Taylor Hughes. And she said, he's basically cured me. And so I waited about a week, and then I called this guy up because I had never met him before. In fact, he was in private practice, didn't know he was in town. I called him up and explained what I had heard from this patient. And I said, you know, you're doing something different than I'm doing. Can I come over and spend a half a day with you and watch what you do? He was a solo practitioner. I think he enjoyed having company. So I went there and watched him and talked about his background and training, and it was very much orthopedic manual therapy related.
Mm-hmm.
And so he told me, you need to take a course from Stanley Paris. And so I went back to the hospital and said, I'd like to go to this course. And they said, well, Bill, you're the newest therapist here. You can go in 2 years. So there was like a pecking order of the way to CE. Well, I wasn't that patient, so I went back to Neil and said, you know, would you be willing to teach a course here in town for the hospital staff, and I'll help try to get other people to come. So he taught 3 courses for us in the Springs, and that's really where I got introduced to manual therapy. And then that led me to go to apply to Stanley Paris's program.
Oh, okay.
So that's where it all started. And then what Stanley gave me, his program gave me, I really didn't have a structured exam, even an examination approach. And so he gave me the basic structure of what should belong in an exam and the skills, and I've just kind of become a mutt since then, incorporating techniques from different practitioners, different schools of thoughts, you know, over the years.
So in the beginning, when you first got your formalized training with Stanley Paris's group, that the way that I phrase it sometimes is that gave you an organization to your assessment and treatments. And then would it be safe to say that over time, once you learn more and more, that you gradually incorporated those things into what you described as a mutt?
Yes. Yeah, you're exactly right. You're exactly right.
One of the things that can be tough with that, at least in my experience or from colleagues of mine, is once you learn an organization like, for example, Stanley Parrish and how he taught you, are there any ways that you incorporated other things into that organization over time? Any kind of strategies that you used for that? Because what I was thinking is that you get so delved into and so much in a groove with how you're doing things that sometimes it can be difficult to branch out and learn something new or put that into the fold of what you already know.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, a couple of good points. Yeah, you can develop big blinders over time and not be open to different ways of doing things.
Right.
Stanley made it clear that while we were in his program, if we wanted to pass the program, we had to do it his way. But he said, once you leave here, he said that he encouraged us to get exposure to other schools of thought. I mean, I learned some techniques in that program that my hands just weren't large enough to easily do. Mm. So part of my transition was just my physical limitations. I found techniques that just worked better for me. Mm-hmm. And that was part of it. But without that basic organization that you mentioned, I could not have evolved. And I'm going to give you an example where part of the evolution that happened was Stanley, his approach was very much heavily based on the objective exam, the physical exam, and very little on history was his approach. Mm-hmm. And, and what I discovered over time that I wasn't getting much from the history because I was a lousy history taker. I just hadn't developed those skills. I recognized that. And so that's where some of the other approaches are probably more heavily weighted on the history side of things. And I just, that fit my personality well, and I thought really made me a better clinician overall. So again, it was that basic organization that I had up front, and that Stanley encouraged us to explore other areas. And I've always been curious anyways, and never really tied to one thing.
Okay, great. Yeah, I think that's great advice for clinicians of all experience levels, is to stay open-minded, stay hungry, and keep learning. So, Bill, I know we're both a little limited on time, but if I can ask you one more question for the moment. You're retired from clinical practice, is that correct?
At the moment, yes, that is correct.
At the moment, yes. So given how long you've been a therapist, and the fact that now you're in a different role, not just clinical practice, but on the professional association side, what still excites you about going to work every day? Either before when you were treating patients or now that you're working with APTA?
That's a good question. And I love what I do right now. And a big part of why I love what I do is the same reason that I enjoy patient care so much. It's the problem solving. Kind of instead of doing clinical reasoning, I'm doing administrative reasoning, but it's based on the same principles. I mean, that's what I enjoyed the most about the patient care was the problem solving and getting people started and empowering people, over whatever brought in, them to see me. And here in my current position, I'm problem solving all the time. I'm troubleshooting all the time. So the reasoning skills that I learned before related to clinical practice fits in here really well. And so that's why I love what I do here. So there's parallels between the two. But I am removed. It's been 2 years since I have seen a patient and then, I build for my services. I work with some other staff and family and friends, but that's why I currently love what I do.
Right. Well, Bill, like I said, I know that we both are limited on time for today. Hopefully, maybe we'll get to speak to each other again and catch up on a few other topics that we didn't get to mention today. But, thank you. especially for the time. I know you're a busy person, like you were just saying, you're problem solving all the time. So I appreciate you taking some of your time to be with us today.
Yeah, well, Matt, well, thank you. I appreciate the invitation, and I enjoyed it as well. And it's great to see you and other therapists who are involved in the profession and the association. I mean, that would be the one thing I would challenge people is to be involved. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's all about the patient. It's all about the profession. Sometimes things happen professionally that aren't necessarily best for me individually, but in the big picture, it's better. And so getting involved is a key item. And so I appreciate all the things you're doing as well.
Well, thanks. Well, hope you have a good day.
Thanks, Matt. You too. Take care.
Thank you.